and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, or even just doesn't know it exists, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is games writer and novelist Carrie Patel. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So please tell us what you have come on the show to talk about today. Give us some context around its background, its release, its reception, why it is maligned, and why you think that that is wrong.
So I'm here to talk about Crawl, which is a cinema classic from 1983. It's a science fiction fantasy blend, a hero's quest kind of movie that came out in that wonderful early mid-80s period when all sorts of other fantasy movies like Dragon Slayer, Excalibur, Conan the Barbarian, and all these other things were coming out, a lot of them in the wake of Star Wars. And so Crawl is a very unusual movie. It is one that I think a lot of people consider a cult film now. and I will be totally honest, I actually had not seen it for many, many years until we decided to do this show, and then I rewatched it just a couple nights ago, and I realized what a challenge I have ahead of me. but I am up for this quest. I am sticking to it, and I'm ready to talk about why this is actually a very entertaining movie and why it's worth consideration.
Excellent. You say cult film. That's actually right on the Wikipedia page. I'm staring at it right now. It says it has since achieved the status of a cult film. Now, what you probably don't know, I've met you and you're quite a bit younger than me. So I'm going to ask you, I'm going to be intrigued to see how you first came across it. I saw this in the cinema.
Oh, wow.
I was, how old would I have been? 11 years old when this was released. And I was just the right age and audience, you know, an 11-year-old boy who loved Star Wars. So I was kind of the perfect audience for this. And I did really like it. I remember it was released really like late in the year. It was middle of winter. And I have very strong memories of watching it, loving it, and walking home from the cinema in the snow at night, like in the dark, replaying the movie over in my mind as I was walking. Mainly, I just wanted a glaive. I really wanted a glaive.
Yeah. So I'm curious, when did you change your mind about this movie?
No, I didn't change my mind. I didn't.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm not blind to its flaws by any means.
Fair enough.
But no, I rewatched it as well for the show, obviously, in preparation. And I still enjoyed it. I mean, yeah, it's not great and it has problems, you know, in quite a few places, but nevertheless, it is fun and I really enjoyed it. So yeah, tell me, how did you first come across it? Because there's no way you could have seen it in the theater. So I assume it must have been on home video.
Yes, it would have been. And I don't remember if it was a movie that we rented from the video, like back in the day when you had Blockbuster. That used to be a thing my mom would take us to on like Friday night, and my sisters and I would all pick out a couple of movies. And I'd usually look for something that had a box cover about like what Crawl has. And that was usually a pretty good sign for me. So I probably either picked it out at Blockbuster or I might have caught it on TV, one or the other. But I just remember, I don't remember exactly how old I would have been, but I was probably somewhere between 6 and 11 when I saw it the first time. And I just, you know, I remember it had all these things I loved, you know, monsters and heroes and battles and flying horses with fire that comes from their hooves. So it was a clear winner for me. And it was just kind of like that and The Neverending Story and Labyrinth. It was just one of those movies that was kind of always on the playlist somewhere.
That's interesting, actually. Yeah, I hadn't thought about sort of comparing it to stuff like Neverending Story and Labyrinth, but now that you say it, it seems kind of, it very much fits in that, that kind of feel of movie, more so than, say, Star Wars, because it was, as you say, so many of these movies were made in the wake of Star Wars' massive success, and so very few of them were successful. And financially, this wasn't successful at all, but you're right that it's kind of, it doesn't feel, partly, I'm sure part of the reason for that is because it doesn't feel like Star Wars. It feels more like, yes, Labyrinth or Neverending Story, like a fairy tale.
You know, and I think one of the criticisms about it, which I think is maybe a little bit unfair, is that it's derivative. And I think what it has in common with Star Wars is like a pretty straightforward hero's journey model. You know, you've got this guy, you know, in Krull, it's Culwin instead of Luke, and he has the call to adventure, and he has this wise old mentor, and he has to, you know, seek this weapon that, you know, you and everybody else who ever talks about this movie in fond terms always remembers, which he strangely does not use at all until the very end of the movie. But, you know, he finds this weapon, he, you know, has to go save this lady, and, you know, it's a very, you know, sort of classic setup, I guess. But I mean, other than that, you're right. It doesn't really have much in common with Star Wars, except, you know, Star Wars was sort of lasers with a side of fantasy, and this is more fantasy with a side of lasers.
It does combine science fiction and fantasy, yeah. Which is always an odd... we talked about this in the recent episode talking about Master of the Universe. Mixing science fiction and fantasy is a perilous task. It's an easy one to get wrong. But, I mean, yeah, you're right. It is derivative, and it does use a fairly standard hero's journey model, but then, you know, what doesn't?
Exactly.
Especially these days, after the success of Star Wars, the hero's journey is literally taught in writing schools, and especially screenwriting schools, as the perfect, you know, sort of, not formula exactly, but the perfect sort of shape of a story. So it's, you can't really knock it for doing that, I think, because the devil is in the detail. Star Wars itself is enormously derivative, but, you know, it's the way it presents the hero's journey and those, you know, copycat elements, like stuff from a Hidden Fortress and what have you, are very, you know, great and very new, and that's what makes it so good.
Yeah, I agree. And I think anything that had come out, you know, this close to Star Wars was gonna get that comparison and that accusation. It's kind of funny because I was curious about what people said about this movie at the time. And there's a 1983 review from Janet Maslin at the New York Times that basically says it's the story of a young hero aided by an older mentor, surrounded by a band of funny-looking sidekicks as he quests after something that will save his kingdom from ultimate destruction, a story that's being told with some regularity these days. And I read that and I thought, well, yeah, just like you said, that's still a story that's really common, whether it's, you know, Lord of the Rings, you know, The Hobbit, even Harry Potter. Like, it's such a common, you know, structure that I don't think you can fault this movie for that. I think the problem that comes in for Krull specifically is that they hit kind of all these plot points, and you almost get the idea that the guy writing the script was like, right, and this is the part where the mentor shows up. Okay, and this is the part where he gets the glaive. Like, these things just sort of happen with little justification or preamble. And it's kind of amusing, like, anytime someone gets recruited in this movie, including Culwin the hero himself, there's almost like, there's a very brief conversation, like, you know, you have to come on this journey. Well, why? Well, because, you know, this has to be done. Well, okay. And you think, well, that was pretty easy. That wasn't too hard. You know, it's like they're just gathering this band. You know, you've got the prince, and then you've got the bandits, and then you've got, you know, the inept magician, and all these people just sort of end up coming along because, you know, the heroes happen to pick them up at the right part of the script. I think the most amusing example of this is probably about midway through, spoilers here, they've, the hero and the bandits and the mentor have gone and found this seer who's supposed to tell them where the Black Fortress, which is one of the cooler elements of the film, like this mountainous fortress that appears at a different place at sunrise every day. The Emerald Seer is going to tell them where the Black Fortress is going to appear the next day. And as they're journeying through the swamp, he gets killed. And he has this young boy who's his assistant, you know, and after they find this old man's body, the boy says, "He was my only family." And Culwin says, "We're your family now, kid." And I'm thinking, like, half of you guys at this point are murderers, and y'all are all going on a suicide mission. This is not a responsible decision. You know, but on the other hand, we also don't see, like, other than the castle that gets, you know, overrun at the very beginning, we don't actually see a single settlement or village. So maybe there really is nobody else to take care of this kid.
We don't see any evidence. We're told that the Beast and his army of slayers have invaded this world of Krull, mm-hmm. but we don't see that anywhere other than the attack at the beginning. We don't see them raiding any towns. We don't actually see them coming in and taking over or attempting to take over. It's really desolate.
We see some lovely mountaintops.
Oh, beautiful scenery, yeah.
But you're right, there aren't really any people there.
Yeah, it's very odd. I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that's my, I can figure this movie a lot, partly through nostalgia and partly because it is earnest. I mean, the thing is that it is clearly made with a sense of, you know, we are trying to tell an exciting adventure story and it's not cynical in any way, which is nice, especially in this day and age. But you're right that they don't. The biggest knock against it for me is that there's no real difficulty. Like, I mean, they have difficulty in that they have, you know, some setbacks, and you know, they'll lose, you know, non-speaking characters fairly frequently, or people with only one or two lines, you know, get a quick, you know, they lose one person at every stage, whittling down the band of the Motley Crue, but. Yeah, and you're right that the Jade Seer is... They go to the Jade Seer, they have this really cool scene where he tries to locate the Black Fortress in his crystal, you know, jade crystal ball, and the Hand of the Beast appears and crushes the crystal out of nowhere. That's really nice. That's like, oh, wow, you know. But then he just goes, oh, it's okay. There's somewhere else where I can go and look instead. It's fine. And he can't touch us there, by the way. He's like, well, why didn't you go there to start with?
Right.
It's they know. I find this is for me a problem with a lot of less successful science fiction and fantasy, which is that too much is known in advance, and as you say, comes too easy. So you know, they just happen. The healer just happens to know where this mythical weapon is located. Even though the Beast has never been to this world before, but he knows that this weapon will kill the Beast and knows where it is. He just happens to be an old friend of the Seer. The Widow of the Web, which we'll come to later, I'm sure. The Cyclops just happens to know where they can find a whole herd of these fire mares, which are very cool.
Which, why don't people have those all the time?
Right.
Like, why don't they raise those in the royal stables?
Exactly. It's like, hang on a second, why aren't you just riding round on these things permanently? And isn't it convenient that there's a herd of them just over the next mountain?
Right.
But like I say, it's made without cynicism, and I think that certainly is rare these days, because, you know, because we live in such a sort of postmodern cynical storytelling age.
Yes, that is pretty refreshing. Yeah, it's in a way, it's almost like, you know, you were talking about, you know, all these little things that just don't work because, you know, they fit together too neatly, or there's no complication or development around them, or there's no explanation. It's, you know, when I was rewatching this, it almost made me think of watching The Room, the Tommy Wiseau movie. I'm sure you've seen that one.
I haven't actually, no, but I've heard all about it.
Okay, well, you have to find someone for this show who will defend The Room, because that would be a very entertaining episode. But the thing that's interesting about watching it is it's just so clumsy in how it handles things as basic as scene transitions and characters entering and exiting, you know, the scene, that you come to appreciate how good every other movie is that doesn't make you think, well, that was a little awkward. Like, huh, that was funny. And you mentioned The Widow of the Web. I think that's actually part of what makes that scene, in my opinion, one of the stronger ones in the movie, is even though it is another kind of strange coincidence, like, oh yes, and this older mentor also happens to know the other one person in the world who can help, and she happens to be nearby, and he's able to go talk to her. But there's something, I think actually the scene where he does reach the web and he talks to her, you know, there's the tension with this big creepy crystal spider that I think is probably one of the few types of creatures that still works pretty well with stop motion animation.
Well, they look like, in real life, they look like they're stop-motion animation, don't they?
Exactly. But yeah, so that it's a wonderful scene with sort of this, you know, threat of death at both the beginning and the end. And then he goes and talks to this woman, and you know, the movie, I think, does a lot of very sparse storytelling, and I think it works pretty well here, where you get this very bittersweet love story that unfolds between the two of them, and it's a pretty interesting counterpoint to the one that's unfolding between, you know, Colwyn, the hero of the movie, and Lyssa, the princess that he's trying to rescue. And it's all very understated, but unlike all of the other scenes where Colwyn or Ynir, this character, enlists the aid of another person, you actually see him appeal to something about the Widow of the Web that is important to her. Like, he appeals to this history they have and to this opportunity that she has, you know, to save somebody else from her fate. And I think it unfolds a lot more elegantly there than it does in any of these other scenes, which is why I think it's probably one of the scenes that people talk about a bit more.
It's definitely memorable. I mean, it's memorable partly, as you say, just because that enormous spider is kind of terrifying. And just the concept of it is horrifying if you are, mm-hmm. you know, afraid of spiders, as any sensible person is. But also, yeah, I mean, it is just a great piece of, it's one of the best pieces of acting, I think, in the movie. And I think a lot of the success of that scene you can put down at the feet of Freddie Jones and, is it Francesca Annis playing the widow, isn't it? Yeah. Because they're just great. You know, two great actors, you know, with nothing that's, I mean, they're in the middle of a crazy looking fantasy set, but there's no props besides mm-hmm. the set. It's just them talking to one another. And, you know, when you get two really good actors doing that, who know their craft and know their characters and have, as you said, that sort of, you know, they can find the emotional center of the whole scene. That's brilliant to watch. And I think even as a child, I think that's why people remember it. Because even as a child, I think we instinctively recognize that as it feels real, even though mm-hmm. it is, you know, a fantasy thing, the emotion of it, it feels real. And they act it so well. I mean, Freddie Jones is probably the best thing in this movie, I would say.
I like Torquil quite a bit too. I think it's Alan Armstrong is very good in his role as well.
Oh yes, Alan Armstrong. You probably don't know, but Alan Armstrong is like a very well-known character actor here in Great Britain, but I don't think he's ever really sort of cracked the US. I'd forgotten he was in it. When he turned up on screen, I was like, wait a second. Because I'm used to seeing him now as like a 50 or 60 year old man.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's been in a couple things that got a little more traction here. Like, I think he had a role in Sleepy Hollow, maybe.
Oh, right.
But yeah, I was looking up on what some of these other actors have done. And you know, yeah, a lot of them seem to have had much larger roles in, you know, shows or movies that were bigger in the UK. But yeah, I admire what, you know, actors like Freddie Jones and Alan Armstrong and Francesca Annis did with these roles, recognizing that it's, you know, not the best of movies and not the greatest of scripts, but I think they carried off what they had very well.
Yeah, I agree. And talking about the sort of writing and direction, it's like it was written by Stanford Sherman, who was mainly a TV writer. He mm-hmm. wrote things like Man from U.N.C.L.E. episodes and quite a bit of Batman and stuff as well. But he also wrote a movie which you've probably heard of called The Ice Pirates.
Yes, I have.
And I didn't know that.
I haven't seen it, but that tells me a lot, I feel like.
Exactly. I didn't know that until I looked it up and I was like, oh, wow, okay.
That explains something.
Yeah. But the director, Peter Yates, mm-hmm. My goodness, what a CV he had. He directed Bullet, mm-hmm. The Deep, Breaking Away, An Innocent Man, you know, like really good, well-directed quality movies. So mm-hmm. I've often wondered if, because none of the movies that he's like best known for are science fiction or fantasy.
Right.
And I've wondered if that may be, you know, he was a great director, but just a bit mismatched for this project.
Yeah. Well, and you know, we were talking about how this, you know, kind of got compared to Star Wars, and it came out in the same year as Return of the Jedi. And, you know, when I was reading up a bit more on this, one thing that I thought was pretty interesting, you know, and it's almost kind of sad looking back on it, is, you know, you watch like a making of, you know, one of the making of features on this, or, you know, you read the production staff talking about it in retrospect. And some people seem to really think that this would be the movie that would like surpass Return of the Jedi. You know, that they would capture that audience and be bigger than Return of the Jedi. And, you look at that now and you're kind of like, what made you think that? I mean, you didn't have Ewoks, granted. but, you know, there was a lot of ambition. And, you know, with something as big and collaborative as a movie like this, you know, when something falls apart, I always kind of wonder, you know, where it happened. You know, like you said, was it that this very skilled director just wasn't really familiar with the genre? Was it that, you know, the production house had, or the studio had all these, you know, very specific sort of demands for, well, you know, this is the formula for the movie that will work, so this is the way you're going to make the movie. You know, was it just a lack of good communication between, you know, a production team that, you know, maybe didn't work together quite as well? It's interesting. Like, you know, even the opening scene, like one of the things that I think is really great about this movie is the James Horner score.
Oh, yes,
it's fantastic. Yes. And, you know, rewatching this, even though I hadn't seen this movie in years, I felt like I could, you know, hear and anticipate each music cue as it was coming up. Like, you know, oh, the Slayers are coming up out of the swamp. It's time for the swamp battle music. I know that one. but, you know, it opens with this very heroic fanfare. And what you're seeing while you're listening to this music is a black mountain floating slowly through space. And it looks kind of ominous, but the music's very heroic. And other than like the mountain flowing and the credits scrolling, there's not really much happening. And so I was kind of like, imagine that there was this conversation like, yeah, we're going to have the opening, you know, kind of like Star Wars. You know, you've got the Star Destroyer kind of cruising through the corner of the screen, which is almost like one of the later shots in that opening scene, you know, when the Black Fortress is floating towards the planet. We're going to have it like that. So, you know, let's get some music in the title sequence. Okay. You know, and then they put it together and it's like, well, wait, there are no lasers. There's no battle. Right, right. Well, I didn't mean the battle part. I just meant the thing floating through space part. And it's like, oh, well, we gave you battle music because you said opening of Star Wars. This probably didn't actually happen, of course. It's interesting to envision how this, you know, might have resulted.
And I can absolutely believe that a conversation similar to that happened, yeah. Because, I mean, if nothing else, if you were going to follow the Star Wars model, you need, you know, Star Wars does have heroic music, but it has it over the titles and crawl. By the time we get to the Star Destroyer coming on screen, the music's changed, and it is ominous music, which, yeah, would have fitted the opening of this movie much better.
Well, and you see the lasers flying, and you see, you know, one ship fleeing and a much bigger ship in pursuit. So, you know, even if you hadn't had that, you know, massive crawl at the beginning of Star Wars, you would understand what's going on. Like, these are probably the good guys, and these are probably the big bad guys, and the good guys are being chased, and it doesn't look like they're going to get away.
Right, and that's not the case here. And not only that, but there's no sense of scale. Like, you're right that this is the huge mountain fortress floating through space, but there's nothing to actually tell us that because, you know, against a planet, everything looks tiny. So
right. And it looks kind of like a meteor. Like, it could be anything, really.
Yeah, the castle is a great design. I think a lot of the design in this actually is really good. The glaive is a fantastic design. Like I say, like, you know, all I could think after I came out of it as a kid was, I want one of those. The mountain, the Black Fortress, is a great design. The beast himself, not so much the beast that we see at the end, but the sort of the glimpses when we get the kind of all the surreal shots of the beast and stuff, that's nice.
Yeah.
The interior design of the fortress, which is really weird and surreal, that's lovely. So there's so many nice bits of design. But yeah, as I say, floating through the blackness of space with nothing at all, like, because, of course, it's not human, so there's nothing familiar to compare it to, nothing to sort of say, this is a huge thing. You just can't tell. And so, yeah, I don't know, it was a really odd choice.
Well, and I think all that weirdness and, you know, the surrealness of so much of the design, I think that's part of why this movie, like, what I loved about this movie as a kid and why it stuck with me. And I think, you know, when I was very young, I was, you know, very content to, like, fill in the gaps myself. You know, it's like, oh, sure, these bandits who were about to rob Colwyn and Ynir now agree to follow them. Well, right, right, because that's just what happens. you know, even though the problem is in the movie, they don't really develop that scene very much. But I accepted it at the time. But the things, you know, that really caught my attention were, you know, like you were saying, the design of the Black Fortress, which, you know, has this strange pseudo-organic look. And it's, you know, and then also these projections kind of like, I think it's the Fingal Caves in Scotland with those very sort of prismatic rock formations. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I think I remember when I saw this movie for a long time, I actually thought the beast was the fortress. Like, there was this sort of weird idea that, well, he's in the fortress because you see him as like a four-limbed entity at times. But I think he's also the fortress because the fortress, like, it has all these things that look like body parts, like a bridge that's like a femur and a window that's an eye and, you know, the big dome chamber that Lissa gets trapped in for most of the movie. When she's walking towards it, it looks like the inside of a mouth,
yep.
You know, like she's walking into this set of teeth. And it's just like so wonderfully creepy. And it's just, I don't know, like it's just the kind of disturbing that's just sort of interesting to chew on for a while.
Absolutely agree. Yeah. It's, it is disturbing actually, which is one of the things that, you know, is sometimes missing from children's movies. I think, you know, too many adults fear that, you know, we can't put sort of weird, surreal, disturbing stuff in because the kids won't like it. But I think, that, you know, certainly as a kid I went for, and it sounds like you did too.
Yeah. And, you know, and the beast himself, it was interesting to kind of watch a brief conversation with, I think Nick Maley was the name of the effects designer that designed his costume. When you see the costume without like all the, you know, all the blur and kind of atmospheric effects, it's actually even creepier. Like it looks almost like his organs are sort of partly on the exterior, like outside his body. Like he's got these sort of fluid sacs where his lungs and heart would be. And, you know, the designer was talking about how, you know, they rigged up this very sophisticated system to, you know, pump all this fluid through these different parts of his body, you know, in real time to give it this living feel. And you don't really catch any of that on screen. And to be honest, I think if you'd seen him too clearly, it, you know, it probably would have been, you know, kind of like seeing the alien too clearly.
Right.
But it was interesting, and it was just as disturbing and weird and, you know, what on earth is this, as, you know, a lot of the other more interesting design choices in the movie.
I really like the idea, actually, yeah, that the beast is the fortress and the fortress is the beast. I wonder, I hadn't considered that, but I wonder how much of that might be down to the poster. Because
yes.
the way it's shown, I'm looking at the poster now, and it almost looks as if they're standing in front of a fortress, but then at the top of the fortress, it sort of merges into the beast's face. So I wonder if that's a sort of a subconscious reaction that you had to the poster.
Well, and also that you never see the beast's full form on screen at the same time as any of the human characters. Like there's one moment where he takes on the form of Colwyn to try to seduce Lissa. But the rest of the time when he's in beast form, you know, it's almost like they're not even shot on the same set and you don't actually know what his scale is. Like I thought he was enormous, or he must've been enormous. And I, you know, and you don't really see like, okay, where in the castle is he? Because she just catches all these glimpses of him when she's looking through these different windows. And then at the very end, you know, he does seem like he is physically present in this, you know, cave structure with Colwyn and Lissa when they finally defeat him. But he's very distant. He seems pretty big. And before that, it doesn't necessarily seem like he's ever occupying the same physical space as the other heroes, except for the fact that obviously, you know, Colwyn does throw the glaive, does hit him with the glaive. And there's a very brief shot when he's trying to retrieve the glaive from his body. When you sort of see his hand reach toward the beast, and you're like, wait, you're that close all of a sudden? And your hand's that big compared to the beast? It's a little strange, but like, yeah, other than that, it's hard to mentally place the beast and any of the other characters in the same physical space, which I think is also part of why I thought that maybe the fortress was just an extension of the beast.
Yeah, no, I think that's in my head canon now. I like it.
Excellent.
You mentioned when he takes Colwyn's form. when Lissa is trapped inside that chamber and he's got the bright red eyes of the beast. That's actually another really, really creepy, disturbing bit, because that actually shows, like, as the main role as Colwyn, Ken Marshall doesn't get a chance to show a lot of range, let's be honest. It's not right. It's not the greatest and most well-written role. But in that, he's brilliant. Like, he's right. So creepy and, you know, kind of just evil. And you're like, oh, wow, he can act.
It's funny because I wasn't even thinking of those two characters as the same person, because it's like, oh, well, that's not the prince, that's the beast. The prince is over here and he's a little questionable. But I mean, you're right. It was the same actor.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's very effective, you know, when he transitions for that brief moment.
Yeah, it's, as I say, I think that's a credit to Ken Marshall, really, because, yeah, that shows that he does actually have quite a bit of range.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, that scene actually brings me to another thing about this movie that I think I probably appreciated on a very subconscious level when I watched it when I was young, and that I appreciated a lot more now, and you'll have to bear with me on this.
Okay.
Which is that for a movie with, like, three speaking female characters, it's not passing the Bechdel test by any stretch of the imagination, it's got some surprisingly feminist overtones, or maybe undertones. And I think one of them is how much of the premise of this movie revolves around Lissa's choice. Like, the prophecy that, you know, Freddie Jones says at the beginning of the movie is, you know, about a queen who will, you know, choose a king, and they'll rule the world, and their son will rule the galaxy. And, you know, it's not just that, you know, she'll marry someone or she'll have a son. It's that she's going to be the one who's choosing who you know, how this goes forward.
Yeah.
And at the very beginning of the movie, it's not enough for the beast simply to abduct her. Like, he has to convince her to choose to marry him and, you know, make him the king of this prophecy. And, you know, I guess that's part of why, you know, her scenes in the Black Fortress are really interesting, and, you know, and that you get to see the set design of this bizarre place. But there's not a lot of tension because you never really believe she's going to choose the beast. And that's why I think the tension of the movie is not about, you know, is she safe? Will she choose him? What's going to happen here? It's really all about, no, can the heroes, you know, get to the Black Fortress before it disappears and moves somewhere else where they can't find it? But yeah, like, that's all just about what she chooses. And the, you know, and, you know, contrasting, you know, Colwyn, who, you know, the Colwyn and Lissa scene at the beginning, like, it's a little cheesy, it's a little silly, but there's, you know, there's shades of a relationship where you see, you know, two equals who, you know, respect each other and come to this marriage as themselves and accepting one another for that.
And they both defy their parents to do so as
yes.
well. You know, yes. Not just him, but she's defying her father as well and sort of effectively saying, look, I know what's best. You think you're trying to protect me, but what I'm doing here is going to save our kingdom, and therefore I'm going to do it, and it's my choice.
You're right. Yeah, that does happen. And, you know, you contrast that with what the beast says to her in the fortress when he's trying to woo her, and he says, you know, you will rule worlds from this fortress. But he's very specific that, like, you're going to be staying here, though, if you choose me.
Right. Yeah, from this fortress.
Yes. And the, you know, the seduction scene, the, you know, where when the beast transforms into Colwyn and he's trying to convince her to give up on the real Colwyn, he shows her this scene where, you know, one of his minions, you know, the third female character, is trying to seduce Colwyn. And it's a really, really brief moment, and it's very easy to miss, I think. You know, but Colwyn very gently rebuffs this person. And, you know, what he says is interesting because he's not saying, like, you know, oh, you know, we're betrothed or we're promised to each other, or, you know, I can't be unfaithful, or I have these expectations for our relationship. It's, well, I can't accept comfort when, you know, she has none. And it's a very, like, it's very empathetic. There's no sense of, you know, sort of possession or obligation or expectation. It's just like, well, it would be unfair and unkind of me to do this when I know she's lonely and suffering at this moment.
That's a really good point. I mean, because that is a good line, but I admit I hadn't really dug into that, why that line is so interesting. But yes, it is exactly that, isn't it? There's no connotation of she's my woman, or even or even I'm her guy, and therefore I can't be unfaithful. There's none of that sort of, oh, well, I would if only I wasn't, you know, tied to somebody or whatever. It's, yes. As you say, it's much more selfless and like, well, how could I? Even if I wanted to, how could I when she is cold and lonely and wondering where I am?
Yeah, and it's another one of, it's funny because for all the scenes that they, that this movie spends a ton of time developing, like, it feels like you watch the heroes and the bandits trying to saddle the fire mares for about 20 minutes. this moment where he gently rebuffs the minion, is, it happens and is over so quickly. And it's another one of those things that, you know, it seems like rather than develop this moment, they said like, oh, well, this is just the part where there's temptation and then the hero resists. And, you know, the minion literally says, you know, I was, you know, she does the thing. She's one of the changelings. So she grows these massive claws out and says, basically, I could have killed you, but in the hour I knew you, I came to love you, which then, you know, you watch that and then you're kind of like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Okay. Now that doesn't make sense. But if you forget about that part, what comes before is actually very touching.
The extending nails. Now, that's creepy. I'd forgotten about that until I rewatched it. I was like, oh, God, yeah, I remember as a kid watching it and being really creeped out by that. I mean, it's a terrible special effect. But the concept of, you know, the way it's done of, oh, yeah, just that, like, extending the nails into somebody's neck.
And the black eyes. I think when I was a kid, like, whenever you'd see a movie where like someone evil had like white eyes or black eyes or just, you know, blank eyes, that always creeped me out. And it's, I think it's actually still pretty creepy now.
I think black eyes I've kind of got used to, but the red eyes that form of the beast has, or the beast form of Colwyn has, those are still, that's still enough to creep me out. I think especially because he's got cat's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
He's got like the vertical slit cat's eyes as well, which is just looks wrong on a human.
It does. Yeah.
Talking about like performances and stuff, the other thing we have to mention is poor Lizette Anthony being dubbed throughout the whole movie.
Yes.
And I mean, and it's not a bad dubbing, but what's wrong with her voice?
I know. Yeah. I didn't realize this either until I was, reading up a bit more about this movie now. And then when I rewatched it, I was like, oh, okay, I can, you know, it's not like there's a flaw, like there's a mistake in it. It's just, I can kind of recognize now that this is what happened. But yeah, you're right. It's such a strange choice. And it's, you have to imagine that would be incredibly frustrating as a performer.
Oh, yeah.
To hear like, oh, yeah. And anyway, someone else is actually going to speak all your lines. So just, you know, run around and get your hair done every day.
Well, and for a movie which is so, it's full of British actors, it's clearly trying to present Kroll as a sort of, you know, a fantasy version of the medieval Europe, as so many fantasy worlds do. And Lizette Anthony is English. So, why dub her with an American accent? It's so strange. I've never understood it. For years, I just thought, because I knew she was English, so I just thought that it was her doing a pretty bad American accent.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it turns out it's a real American person.
Well, and it's strange because, like, yeah, both she and Colwyn have American accents, and as I remember, their fathers both have English accents.
Yes,
right?
And I think every other character in the movie, I don't think there are any other speaking characters who have American accents.
Yeah, you're right, that is very strange.
That's, I don't know, weird. But yeah. The dubbing, talking about production decisions and studio interference, that was a sort of post-production thing imposed. Well, I say imposed upon them. It was a post-production decision, which I assume was imposed upon them by the studio, just because otherwise, why wouldn't you have just chosen, when you were casting, why wouldn't you have just chosen an American actress?
Right.
You know, if you wanted her to have an American accent. So I assume it was imposed on them by the studio. But yeah, it was definitely a post-production decision. And I mean, did it ruin the movie? No. But would it have ruined it not to do that? No.
Right, exactly.
Very strange. And actually, when I was rewatching the other, talking about sort of other fantasy works, when I was rewatching the opening scene, immediately made me think, oh, it's the Red Wedding.
Yeah.
Maybe wonder if George Martin watched this and thought, huh.
Something I can use here, but more death.
Yeah. Oh, dear. But you're right. It's, you know, it, this is what I said earlier about it being sort of lacking cynicism. The love story is a little bit naive. You know, it's not fully developed, especially, as you say, compared to the roping the fire mares. Which, you know, I'm sure hiring 20 Clydesdales for a week is probably very expensive. So they wanted to get the most bang for their buck.
Yeah.
Make sure the money's on screen. But in a way, it's kind of nice that they don't spend loads and loads of time on the romance, because it must have been very tempting to do that with it when you've got a story like this and you have two very pretty young actors like Ken Marshall and Lizette Anthony, both of whom, you know, very, very photogenic, good looking, good on screen actors. It must have been very tempting to really up, you know, the ante of the romance stuff, especially when they don't even appear on screen for most of them together for most of the movie.
Right. Yeah. I agree with you on this. I'm glad they didn't spend a lot more time on it. And I think this is one of the elements, you know, sort of the backstory of their relationship that I think is easy enough to fill in the blanks from what you do see. Like we said earlier, you do see that, you know, she is very much taking charge of, you know, making sure that this marriage goes through. You get that this was sort of her idea and that she and Colwyn are very complicit in it. You get that there's a save the kingdom, you know, motive, but that they also really seem to like each other, which is nice. And I think I was comfortable sort of filling all that in the background. You kind of wish that for the few scenes they do have on screen together, that maybe they could have been given some slightly punchier lines. I don't know. Like, I like this. I like the substance of what you see, which is, you know, they kind of both tease each other, and you get that they're both sort of, you know, I don't want to say testing each other's boundaries, but, you know, playing just a little bit and establishing themselves, but in a very sweet way. And I think that's a nice dynamic. I think it's just the execution of it that feels a little bit lacking, which I guess is sort of the overall problem with the movie, is that there are so many great ideas from, you know, again, like everything we were talking about with the Beast and the Black Fortress and this really cool weapon that we still talk about. It's just, you know, and this band of thieves, you know, joining the hero. It's just the execution of these elements that seems to fall short.
It is lacking, yeah. Rewinding a little, talking about things coming easy, that's something else that I meant to mention earlier. When we're talking about the glaive, he gets it quite easily, doesn't he? Considering that it's hidden, you know, in, what is it, a cave on the highest peak of the highest mountain range and all that sort of thing. And then he just climbs up there, walks in, and plunges his hand into hot lava with no discomfort whatsoever, apparently, and plucks it out.
Yeah. Well, and this is another moment where there's a really lovely, like, the sound, you know, the score at this point is also really nice, but
yes,
it does not suggest danger in the least. Like, it looks like a very pleasant afternoon hike, and he looks like he does it in the space of an afternoon. And it's funny because, like, sort of the one other sort of, you know, this could be dangerous moment is when you've got these boulders that start rolling down the hill. And he dodges them mostly by staying in place.
Yes.
You know, so it's like they didn't quite commit to the action here. They wanted to show you some danger, but waiting turned out to be the right option.
That whole scene made me think, I wonder if that was put in there because they thought there'd be a tie-in video game.
And there was, and that is a scene, like that is part of one of the tie-in video games.
Is it?
I think there were a couple, yes. There's some rock dodging.
Oh man. Yeah, as soon as I saw it, I was like, well, what is the point of that? Because you're right, he barely moves. And he gets he does actually get hit by one of them. If you look closely, you watch, he gets hit by a rock.
Yeah.
And it sort of glances off his arm, but it appears to do no damage because, of course, it's made of polystyrene.
Yeah, so you're like, no wonder he's not moving. This isn't worth it.
Yeah. Oh dear. But yeah, the I mean, the soundtrack when he goes in the cave is great. The visuals in the cave are great. You know, the whole scene looks lovely. The glaive itself mm-hmm. kind of having been, you know, crusted over in lava rock and then it falls away and you've got the lovely starburst filter. So there's, you know, light shining everywhere. It looks amazing. Mm-hmm. Great soundtrack. It's just, yeah, there's no trial whatsoever to get it other Mm-mm. than can you climb this really tall mountain, which where there's no snow at the top, by the way, so it can't be that tall.
That's true.
Oh dear.
Yeah, and then he gets down to the bottom of the mountain where Ynir is waiting, and the first thing he wants to do is like throw it like a boomerang, and you know, yeah. Freddie Jones is like, wait, kid, not yet. And you know, just as you're starting to think like, huh, this guy climbed this mountain like it was no big deal, you're like, oh, maybe he's not ready yet.
Yeah, yeah. Although it is, that does then lead, as you say, unfortunately, to him not using it at all until basically the end of the movie.
Yes. It's interesting because it is such an iconic weapon. And, you know, as someone else put it, it basically gets used as a glorified rotary saw. It's... Aha, now it's time to use the glaive to cut open the strange dome that Lysette Anthony is trapped in.
Well, he does use it kind of like a Tron disc as well on a couple of the Slayers.
Yes. You know, but like one thing is, if he had been using it all the time, like, you know, noting how effective it is, would any of the fights really have been, and how good he is with it for someone who is not at all trained? Yeah. Like, this is worse than Luke with the lightsaber. Like, he just picks this thing up and he knows what to do with it. But, you know, you think, well, yeah, all of these other fights would have been over in a heartbeat if he'd been using this the whole time. At least, you know, they had to dodge some lasers and swing from some chandeliers and, you know, roll around and do all that business. But, you know, like, I guess the other thing that actually, you know, looking for a defense here, that is kind of nice about not using the glaive more often. I mean, for one thing, it never comes to feel mundane, you know?
Right.
It doesn't come to feel like something that you just kind of whip out whenever trouble shows up. But the other thing is, it doesn't actually, if he'd used it all the time, it also would have seemed like, well, the glaive is the hero of this movie. Like, that's why they win. But it's like, well, no, they actually get to the black, you know, Colwyn and Ynir and, you know, their whole, you know, band of troops, they get to the Black Fortress because they work together. And, you know, another like very uncynical, very sweet kind of sentiment. Is, you know, they get there by working together and sacrificing together. And when Colwyn and Lyssa defeat the beast at the end, it's not with this, you know, magical weapon that he pulled out of the lava. It's with the power of their love.
Yes.
You know, and the fire in their hands. Like, she's even like, it wasn't the glaive, it was you. And then he says, no, it was us. And then they burn the beast. And it's a little over the top, but it's very sweet and it's very uplifting in a way. And like you said, just another thing about this movie that is so refreshingly uncynical.
Right. It's just completely lacking in, you know, cynicism or postmodernism. It is, which is why I think it is. And that's why I said at the start that I think I was kind of the target age when I saw it, in that I think it is best viewed for the first time anyway by preteens. I think once you hit puberty, you know, once you become a teenager and go through that whole process, you are going to be so cynical about this movie.
Yeah.
But if you can get somebody to watch it before they hit that stage, I think there is, you know, because pre-puberty you can appreciate things like that, I think, unironically, without irony, without cynicism, and just in that kind of naive, as you say, uplifting fashion where you can take things at face value.
Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, I know one of the criticisms about this movie that, you know, we've also talked about is that, you know, Colwyn isn't very charismatic. He doesn't seem all that heroic. And there's this kind of moment early in the movie that people sort of poke fun at when, you know, he's the only survivor, of course, of the wedding massacre. And, you know, Ynir, the mentor, comes and finds him. And, you know, Colwyn is very upset. And Ynir's, you know, saying, buck up, kid. And, you know, Colwyn says, well, you haven't lost a bride and a father in the same day. And he's very emotional about it. And, you know, it's not a very heroic expression. But I remember thinking that even if it maybe is, it does come across as a little whiny. But I think the sentiment there that, He actually feels these things deeply. And this isn't just, you know, a quest that we're all going to watch because it's a fun adventure. You know, this is something that is very upsetting. And, you know, he cares about these people that he's lost, is also kind of refreshing in a way.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, let's face it, if we can all get behind, you know, but I was going to go to Toshi Station and buy some new power converters. You know,
right.
Whiny is a word that has been used to describe Luke in the early, early scenes of Star Wars many times. You know, that's fine. Mm-hmm. The important thing is that you get over the whining, you know, and become the hero. And Colwyn absolutely does that. I mean, yeah, he isn't the most charismatic character. But as I say, I think I've long thought that that's more to do with how he's written and what's, you know, and possibly even the direction that he was given, you know, because this is back in an age where directors were generally much more willing to tell an actor, literally tell an actor, I want you to do it like this. You know, and actors were more willing to say, okay, and go along with the director. That's not so much the case anymore for, you know, many reasons, but certainly up until the late 70s, mid 80s, that was very much the case. So he may have just been given bad direction, because we see, as I say, when he's playing the Beast as Colwyn, that he can clearly be I mean, that's evil charisma, but nevertheless, he's got charisma. So he can clearly do it, but it's just missing from this character, which is such a shame.
And even, you know, even though he's not incredibly charismatic, I always felt that the character of Colwyn was very likable, which I think was another thing I liked about this movie. It's like, he genuinely just seems like a good person, and his interactions with all of the other characters, whether it's, you know, his bride Lyssa, or these bandits he recruits, or, you know, this kid that he suddenly decides is part of the family. You know, even if some of it is maybe a little underdeveloped, like, he is a compassionate, gentle person who he doesn't really get set off by any of these things. Like, you know, he laughs at some of these characters who are, you know, making fun of him or trying to kill him. Like when he encounters the bandits, and when he encounters the magician who insults him a ton, like, you just see him having fun. You don't see him, you know, about to go off the deep end about any of this.
Yeah, he's friendly, and he's an optimist, you know. Yes. Both of which are fairly rare characteristics are in leading characters these days.
Yes.
Talking about the magician, we haven't mentioned Ergo the Magnificent really yet. I mean, that's such a strange role as well, because obviously it is slapstick. But he also has some good lines, because he, of course, he is cynical and sort of put upon. But he, I think, you know, he plays it quite well, overplays it a little bit, but quite well. But one of the things, you know, the other character who I certainly remembered all, you know, throughout the years, is the Cyclops, Rell.
Yes. Who, we haven't even talked about him.
Right. And he's such a sort of, you know, physically imposing character, played by Bernard Breslau, who most people will know from the Carry On movies. But obviously here, not playing a comedy character. He was 6'7". So, you know, yeah, stick him on a pair of platform boots like they have here, and he towers above everybody. So he looks great. He doesn't say a lot. He's a very, one of those, you know, sort of strong, quiet characters. But he's, you know, you still sort of warm to him, especially because of the Cyclops backstory that they give them. But the interactions between him and Ergo, and the sort of growing friendship, again, understated, you know, they don't make a lot of it, but it you know, it has a certain, it gets to you, you know, you it comes across, and nowhere more so for me than the very last line, the last line that they speak after they've roped the Firemares, and for some reason, you know, the Cyclops knows that it's his time to die. So he says, I'm going to stay here. You go on without me. And Ergo says, like, come on. He's like, no, it's my time. I'm going to stay here. And all Ergo says is, we had no time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a sad line.
It is.
Again, it's not, you know, you have to kind of take it in a non-cynical, naive way, but it is such a not overly sentimental, but true and sad line.
Well, and now that you mention it, I remember watching that moment, and, you know, we're talking about all of these other character moments that feel sort of underdeveloped or unjustified. That was one moment that I absolutely believed. And it's impressive because, you know, they pull it off with, again, relatively little on-screen interaction. And, like, you know, there aren't really a lot of scenes that are just Ergo and Rel talking it up. You know, there are a few, and you see this sort of dynamic between them developing, but it is done in a pretty subtle way. And yet when you get there, you're like, yeah, that's really sad, you know, and that's true. I think one of my other favorite moments, both between them and in the movie, is when they're wandering through the swamp and Ergo is, you know, sort of teasing Titch, the boy, and, you know, he's talking, you know, one of Ergo's things is that he loves gooseberry pie, and he's like, I want a mountain of gooseberry pie. What would you wish for? And the boy says, a puppy. And he's like, just one puppy. You should wish for a lot of puppies. And he's like, I only want one puppy. And then he says, well, what would you wish for, Rel? And Rel says, ignorance. And yeah. it's kind of it's a buzzkill, but it's also, you know, a nice kind of a little jab and a reminder of what this guy is all about and how lonely his existence has been and how much more meaningful it is now that, you know, he very briefly finds this group of people to travel with.
Yeah. Well, and then you also get, following on from that, the interaction later when Ergo turns himself into a puppy for, you assume, for an hour or two, so that the boy can have a puppy. And and nobody else seems to know that this is what's happened, apart from the boy and Rel the Cyclops. And then when he changes back, and Rel's there watching him change back, and he just sort of dusts himself down and goes, I still say it was a foolish wish. And that's it. And that's the entire interaction. But again, it's enough. You can read into it that, like, you know, that Rel clearly appreciates what he did for the boy. It's really sweet.
Yeah, and there's, you know, this is another thing that I don't think I thought much about watching it as a kid, but, you know, watching it now as an adult, I was like, whoa, they did this. You know, Ergo keeps turning himself into all these animals, and they're, you know, very, you know, like cute, very undangerous animals, like puppies and pigs and geese and what have you. And then at the end, another very touching moment is he transforms himself into a tiger to defend the boy in the Black Fortress. And I was watching that with a new appreciation, both of how you see, you know, this character become sort of a very caring uncle figure from initially being very dismissive of the boy. But then there's that scene later when, you know, as a tiger, he's gotten wounded, and the boys, and the whole time I'm watching this, I'm like, wow, I wonder if they really filmed the kid and the tiger on the same, you know, in the same stage. Like, they couldn't have done that. They probably had to put the tiger or the kid in later, because there's no way you could have like a 10-year-old boy and a dangerous animal on stage at the same time. And then later you see like the kid cradling the tiger's head in his lap and, you know, soothing him. And I'm like, oh my gosh, they really shot that. Yeah. And I'm sure when I was young, I watched that, I was like, oh, that's so sweet. It's a tiger. How awesome. You're petting a tiger. And now I'm like, this is so dangerous. Who said this was okay?
Right, because this is well before the age when you could have pulled that off with CGI. And it's also clearly not an animatronic. It is clearly a real tiger.
Mm-hmm. chill tiger.
It is a good scene as well. Yeah, as you say, you see him kind of become the boy's protector and willing to sacrifice himself. That's the other thing. When he's cradling the tiger, that's because he's dying.
Yeah.
Before we close up, one last thing I've got to mention is right at the end when they win and they sort of, you know, go out into the field, the meadow field full of flowers and what have you, and we see the Black Fortress crumbling. I love how it crumbles upwards.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like almost as if it's returning to the stars.
Another touch that's a little bizarre, and like they never explain why that happens, and they don't have to, but I think it's one of those things that it just works because it's a little different from what you'd expect, and I think it underscores just how unusual this world is and how, you know, strange the powers at work in it are.
Right. It's magic.
Yes, it is. Now, like a lot of the other sequences, I think maybe it takes just a little bit too long, you know, to finish the crumbling. But it is a nice effect. I think that's the thing is, you know, people call this movie slow. That's another big criticism. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if it's so much that the whole movie is slow as that you've got all these sort of set piece sequences where you can tell someone's like, you know, all right, They're roping the fire mares. They're riding the fire mares. The castle is crumbling. And it just takes a little bit too, you know, he's climbing the mountain and it just takes a little bit too long to get through it. And it's a lot of kind of, look at this, look at how cool it is. Isn't this awesome? But like, there's nothing really changing in the scene. It's not very dynamic.
Yeah, it's, you're right. It's individual scenes that go on too long. I'm just looking at who edited it, actually. It was edited by Ray Lovejoy, who is an editor of some note, it should be said, including The Shining, 2001, mm-hmm. which, okay, fair enough. You could
all, talk about long shots. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Aliens, absolutely not. I mean, that's a very snappily edited movie. A couple of other movies with the same director, Suspect and The House on Carroll Street. Yeah, loads of stuff. The remake of Lost in Space, well, you know, maybe not. but yeah, you know, he had a long and storied career. He was nominated for an Academy Award for Aliens, in fact. Yeah, once again, it's really hard to see, like, where does, if there is blame to be apportioned, where does it fall?
You know, and I think one thing in general that I kind of miss about movies from this era and before, and like, the original Alien and Aliens are both big examples of this, is like, the willingness to develop a slow burn. Like, it's about half an hour in both of those movies before anything, you know, anything really bad happens. But they're not dull by any stretch of the imagination. Like, there's plenty happening and there's plenty building. It's just a slow burn. And it's interesting to look at something like the Die Hard series, where, you know, the first movie, it's the same thing. It's like 30 minutes of marital woes before the terrorists show up. And it's all good. And, you know, I think it's a fantastic movie for doing it that way. But, you know, then you watch some of the more recent movies, like even as recent as Die Hard 3, which I think was mid-90s, and it opens with an explosion.
Yeah.
I regret sometimes that, you know, it seems that people are less willing to make movies that, you know, that gather their tension so gradually.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say that's, I agree with you. But then, you know, I'm old, so I'm bound to say that. But yeah, I think to your surprise, I do love this movie.
That's wonderful. Yeah,
for all of its flaws. What would you say? Would you agree that, you know, it's best to show it to, because, I mean, there's certainly nothing in it, well, apart from the Slayer's weird alien thing, creature inside their helmets, which is a bit, even now, is still a bit like creepy and like yucky. But apart from that, there's nothing sort of unsuitable for young children, is there? So I would definitely say people, if they have young children, prepubescent children, show them this movie now before they get cynical.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's the right time to watch it. The right time to come to appreciate the things we're talking about, you know, before you start getting hung up on some of its flaws. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I could, you know, I could drink Cokes all day. In Texas, Cokes are all sodas. So, you know, you like, kids have no limit on the sweet tooth. Like, they can tolerate almost infinite amounts of sugar. And I think it's probably the same way with cheese in movies. You know, this stuff just doesn't hold you up, because you're either like, yeah, I am totally invested in this, and I am, you know, papering over the flaws and the plot holes with my own headcanon, I'm good to go. I think that's definitely the right age to watch this and start to appreciate it.
Absolutely. All right, Carrie, thank you very much for joining us to talk to us about Krull today. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say about five-pointed throwing weapons?
You can find me on Twitter at Carrie_Patel. That's Carrie _Patel. And I also have a blog at electronicinkblog.com.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my other work, including comics, books, music, and more, at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find more information about all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up, and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. And the show notes for this episode are at UMP.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Yeah, did you really think that I didn't like this movie? What made you think that?
You know, I don't know. I think part of it is as a rational person, I watched this and realized, like, yeah, this is not a fantastic movie. Like, this is a very flawed movie. So, you know, I think I just imagined that probably, and like, I couldn't even convince my husband who loves 80s stuff and is always accusing me of being, you know, being the cynical critic. I could not get him to watch this movie with me. So I was like, chances are probably good that this is not going to be a popular choice with anybody else.
Has he not seen it before?
He has not seen this one, no.
But I couldn't convince him to watch it.
No, I think part of it is also we're in the middle of, like, we play a lot of video games together, and right now, you know, we just started Mass Effect Andromeda, and so I think when we're hanging out in the evenings, I think gaming is generally rather what he'd do rather than,
right.
You know, watch a rather campy movie he may or may not really appreciate.
You mentioned earlier the Slayers coming out of the marsh water when they rise out of the marsh. That, again, is another image that has stuck with me for, you know, 30 years since I first saw this movie. So memorable.
Yeah, it's... You know, I feel like overall the Slayers were probably one of the less compelling things about the movie to me, just because they, you know, at least what you see for most of them is fairly like, you know, guy in a suit. And for all the other elements of this movie that are just so wonderfully weird, that element I think always felt a little more mundane. But you know, whenever they die and you see that slug thing crawl out of their hair, you know, crawl out of their heads, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. And never made any more of.
Yes, exactly. No one explains it. Like, they'll go into the ground. Where do they go? What are they going to do? I don't know. No one says. I think there's also something, and maybe this isn't as unique to Kroll as I'm trying to say it is right now, but a fairly grown-up sense of, like, this not being about adventure for adventure's sake. You know, you see at least at the start that, like, you know, we're talking about how Colwyn is very broken up over the loss of his father and his bride. And I think there's an interesting contrast between, you know, Colwyn's love story and Ynir's love story. And that, you know, you see that Colwyn is going through all this, you know, to rescue the woman that he loves and settle down and rule responsibly and raise a child together. You know, you get the feeling that when they march out of the Black Fortress, they're not looking for more adventures. Like, you know, they're going to go home and create a stable family and a stable kingdom.
Right.
But, you know, the whole reason that Ynir's love story ends so sadly is because, you know, he did have this love and this child. And, you know, for reasons that are never quite explained, he walked away. And he became, you know, this very legendary figure. But he kind of turned, he walked away from all of this, you know, stability and these responsibilities that Colwyn is very actively seeking. And so they sort of seem like each other's stories in reverse in a way.
Yeah, that's, I hadn't thought about it like that. That's interesting, yeah. Although you just reminded me, there was one other thing about the Widow of the Web. You mentioned that, you know, in some ways there are some sort of feminist undertones, overtones in this movie. And the Widow of the Web scene, as we said, is very memorable, very well done. However, watching it now with modern eyes, that whole business about her killing their only child, and that's why she's been punished, and now she's expected to give up her own life for that of a beautiful young woman because she's old and evil. And I was like, that doesn't run so well in 2017.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You're right, that does feel very different now than it probably did at the time.
I think it was just, that sort of thing has been such a trope, which is why you know, it's like seen as a negative trope now because it's so been so prevalent throughout the ages. But and the whole thing is still very, very effective and creepy, that scene. But yeah, mm-hmm. watching it now, I was like, oh, is this the only way we can show an old woman? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And by making her young and pretty for a little while first.
Oh, God, yes, of course.
Yeah. I mean, it's touching in a way because I think what it means to those characters is you still see the best in me.
Right.
And you still care about me despite everything that's passed between us, you know, but again, it's this, very old man for a moment with this, you know, very young, beautiful woman who is suddenly redeemed by looking young and beautiful again.
The Bandits is a cornucopia of British character actors. Did you also spot
Liam
Neeson in there? Yeah, in one of his first ever
Coltrane.
Film roles. And Robbie Coltrane.
Yeah.
And Todd Carty, who you probably won't recognize again. He's really only known to Brits, but he was... I'm trying to think which character he is. He's the character with the hat, with the sort of like fur-lined hat. Doesn't really
he's
do
not,
a
he's
lot.
He's not the youngest one then. Like one of the ones who survives at the end?
Do you know, I'm trying to think if he survives or not. He is definitely one of the youngest ones, yeah. I can't actually remember if he makes it out or not.
I remember he's got kind of black bushy hair. Yeah, he doesn't talk a lot.
He does. That's right. Yeah. He makes it out of the spike room. Yes, he's the other one who makes it out along with Alan Armstrong, yeah.
What else has he been in?
Well, he was in a series called Grange Hill, which was a high school drama for kids, which ran for years over here in Britain. And then he, when he grew up, he transferred from that into EastEnders, one of our longest running soaps.
I've heard a lot about EastEnders. I've never seen it.
Right. Well, it's just a soap, you know, set in London, full of miserable people having miserable lives, as all British soaps are, really. They're very
delightful.
Much not like American soaps at all. But yeah, so it was a case of spot the character actor, all these people mm-hmm. cropping up. But yeah, Liam Neeson with his real accent for once. Quicksand.
Yes, that's another example of like, why did you choose this as one of your long action sequences? It's like, you know, the music's up and you know it's perilous, but the thing about Quicksand is everything just moves so slowly. And it is a fairly long sequence. And like, you see that they're sort of pulling each other, you know, out, and they're leaving one guy behind. And then once they're all out, you see them look at this last guy who's still in the quicksand who, you know, has been selected as the red shirt for this episode. And it's like, okay, now how do we go back and get him out? But yeah, it's like, you know, they slowly pull themselves out and then they just have to slowly pull themselves back in. And it's lots of reaching and straining, but you know, it's kind of like holding onto the mountainside and waiting for the rocks to roll by. There's some tension there, but it's,
not enough to justify 5 minutes of screen time.
Exactly. Yes.
But Quicksand was every 1970s kid's greatest fear. So many movies in the 70s had people dying in quicksand. It's like, you don't see it much anymore, I think, because people have realized that it's all rubbish and that it's actually really, really hard to drown in quicksand. But you go back and look at movies from the 60s and 70s and so many people drown in quicksand. It's this weird cinematic trope.
You know, now that you mention it, I know exactly what you're talking about. I feel like that is something that I used to see in a lot of these movies that I watched when I was young. And I think I remember even asking my parents one day, like, not that I was super concerned, you know, living in Houston, but I was just a little bit concerned, like, where is this stuff? And like, how does it work? And how do you avoid it? And they're kind of like, trust me, you don't need to worry about this.
Yeah.
You know, there are other things you should worry about.
Yeah. Okay. Your chances of ever walking into quicksand are pretty low.
Yes.
And even if you do, the chances of you drowning in it are even lower.
Yeah. Instead of it just being this thing that's everywhere, like in deserts and swamps.
It is. It's such a strange thing.
And Neverending Story also. We were talking about the Neverending Story. That's how the horse dies.
Oh,
it's like the saddest scene in the movie. But it's weird because right there, it's the swamps of sadness. So it's not just that the swamps pull you in on their own. It's they pull you down because you're sad and you give up.